This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. And over the next 2 weeks, we're going to be talking with the primary congressional candidates from North Carolina's 2nd District. They include Frank Roach, Clay Aiken, Keith Crisco, and Toni Morris, as well as incumbent Renee Elmers. Congresswoman Elmers has declined to be on this program. We will talk with her Republican challenger, Frank Roach, who is a financial market economist and talk show host on WRDU-FM. Frank, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Nice to be with you, Frank.
And we should say you've suspended the talk show while you're doing this campaign.
That's right. That's right. You know, as you know, Frank, when you talk for 3 hours, you say a lot of silly stuff. And so why give the other side too much ammunition?
Always one breath away from the end of my career.
That's right.
I know how you feel. What do you think sets you apart from Renee Elmers?
I think the simplest explanation to that is knowledge and experience. I've been studying the U.S. economy since 1983. I hold a master's degree in economics. I worked in capital markets, putting my economics training to work every single day of my life as a professional. And it gave me a real expertise on the issues, both economic and public policy stuff. And I think through that time, I've been able to connect the dots of the bad public policy coming out of Washington, D.C. in a way that the incumbent challenger doesn't seem to be able to do.
All right, she's got experience over you in serving in public life. She has been in the office, right?
That's right. Experience. She does have that experience of being an elected official. I don't see the evidence that she's grown in terms of understanding of public policy, but I'm sure in terms of parliamentary procedure, she has the advantage over me. But I'm happy to learn that quickly.
All right. Here's one policy issue that I know you disagree on. That's immigration reform. Congresswoman Elmers would like to see a pathway to citizenship. You think that's a big mistake?
I do. And that's a semantic twist of words that Republicans have been using for a long time. It was the phrase that Democrats used. And it's a semantic twist to basically say the same thing. Want to give citizenship to those who entered the country illegally. I think it's the wrong thing to do. I'm focused on the enforcement of our current laws, what's important for American citizens in the 2nd District. You know, Frank, we have very clear evidence all around the country that we're challenged economically. We know Americans are struggling to get good jobs, proper paying jobs, pay their bills. I don't understand why you'd want to make that more difficult for our fellow Americans. Now, I understand those people are here right now, but the competition still exists, and the amnesty only induces more to come and do the same. Ronald Reagan tried this in 86. He admitted his mistake. It's only gotten worse since then. We cannot go down this path. Republicans are wrong on this issue.
Well, let's talk about those jobs and the impact it would have. I mean, we've got an unemployment rate that's still very high, 7-8%. It's hovering around there. With all of that unemployment, why would it still be a try? In other words, why aren't these folks working? Why aren't people in jobs right now?
Well, I think I've identified the reasons, Frank. It's bad public policy out of Washington, D.C. You know, I always come at everything from an economics perspective. I don't have a PhD and I've never held a job as an economist, but I work as an economist every single day. And when we had open borders, immigration, massive debt and deficits, U.S. unilateral free trade policy with China, overregulation, and a failing education system, American citizens are behind the eight ball here. We're in real trouble in terms of our ability to create wealth, family formation, business formation, and we have the evidence. The wage gap is growing, labor force participation rate at post-World War II lows, employment population ratio at post-World War II lows. And for me, Frank, there's one key metric. It's a little economically wonkish. It's called real per capita gross domestic product. It's at post-World War II lows, and that incorporates our final economic output each year, but adjust for inflation and population. And that's a very damaging metric for us. We need to keep an eye on that.
Let's talk. I'm going to stick with immigration for just a minute because the folks are here. They're filling jobs. They're doing things right now. If we were to say, let's say we could enforce the law tomorrow, send everybody home, fill those jobs with America. I mean, what would the cost be? Agriculture certainly has come to depend on that labor force. Remember, Renee Elmers is not saying that they shouldn't pay a penalty. She'd like them to pay a penalty, to admit violating the law, so that there wouldn't be an amnesty. You wouldn't be off the hook. But it acknowledges that those folks are here doing stuff now, and I'm not sure what it would cost if we sent everybody home. What do you think?
That's a great point, Frank. And it's important to comment clearly to those listening to us today. If we want to solve America's challenges in order to make America greater for American citizens, there is no painless solution. If we want to correct immigration as I perceive it to be a problem, though, there will be people negatively impacted by that. If we were to, as you suggested, deport everyone tomorrow, which is not feasible and not something I'm suggesting, there would be a gap in our economy. There's no denying there is a transition that would have to occur from our dependence on this low-skilled source of immigrant labor. And it's not just low-skilled. We have it at the high end as well. There would be an adjustment. But, Frank, you know, I have a solution. I'm not saying zero immigration. I'm not saying agriculture doesn't matter. It's critical to us, right? Food matters for human beings. All I want to say is let's make it work for Americans first. We have a solution. I have a solution that can fill that gap in. And it's something that doesn't involve amnesty.
What is it?
It is essentially, Frank, turning our work visa program into our legal visa program, moving away from family reunification as the basis of our program, moving back toward an economics need-based system where legal immigration drops well below 500,000 people per year, and we supply the labor we need for agriculture, construction, hospitality. There's a way to do this without blowing up the rest of our society, without dividing us by language, culture, and ethnicity, without keeping them in the shadows, so to speak. But they're not in the shadows, right? They're all around us. So there's a solution, Frank. It requires a courageous adjustment on legal immigration. Make legal immigration our H-1B visa program. And we
solve our
problems.
Yeah, but does that mean allowing as many people who are here illegally in the country now? Because there's a market force at work here. Those folks are here. They're risking life and limb. They're making enormous sacrifices to be here, and they're working.
Yeah.
Right? They are actually working. So if we limit that number, if we shrink the number, doesn't the market tell us, that number's got to be higher?
Well, Frank, if you want to focus on market forces, I would suggest you look at labor wage rates in construction, hospitality, and agriculture. If you want to look at market forces and supply and demand, you've seen no real wage increases over the past 25 years in those sectors. And that is because labor supply is not a problem. Those are your market forces. And Americans are being damaged by that repeatedly. Now, there's a whole cultural discussion we need to have, Frank, as well. I think in the household, respect to parents, to suggest to their children there's no job that is not good enough for them. I grew up in a household, you worked whatever job you could get, dig a ditch, that's fine. So we need to change that cultural discussion for Americans. If you think you're above a certain job, I would ask you to check yourself.
All right. So that's kind of a cultural question for us then. Let's talk about the Affordable Care Act. Where
sure.
are you on that?
It has to be repealed as soon as possible. I remind you again, I come at everything from an economics perspective, Frank. The premise of the program will not sustain itself. The idea that we can get increased access, lower costs, and higher quality will not happen. Right now, there's a lot of excitement about this, the sign-ups, the idea that people that didn't have health insurance now have health insurance. And that is cool. That is exciting for some if you didn't have that and you're getting it now for nothing. But, Frank, we can't only focus on the benefits of public policy. At some point, we must bring the other side of the equation in. And the other side of the equation is costs. And for the past 15, 20 years, and certainly with Obamacare, our elected officials have forgotten the cost side of this equation. Frank, we don't know it now, but in 5 or 6 years, we'll know the truth of this if Republicans allow it to stay in place. And the cost side of this is going to blow out everything, both in terms of access to medical care and the hook that the government is going to be on through taxpayer dollars, providing those people with health insurance and the medical care that comes
in. How is the rest of the developed world able to do it? Single-payer systems where they're really nationalized health care systems and they're paying less than half per capita in health care costs with better outcomes. How do they do it and not go broke?
Well, they aren't not going broke. They're all going broke.
Canada, Japan, Italy.
Well, Frank, I would urge your
UK?
Listeners right now, go find the data. Go look at the data of Canada's long-term debt and deficits. Go look at the imbalance between tax revenues and costs on medical expenditures. Do it in Germany. Do it in the UK. Do it in Japan. You will find the basic truth that the costs are way swamping the revenues that come in from those programs. If we always ignore the cost side of every public policy, everything will always look great. We must consider this cost side. It's critical to us. Your station right here could not exist without considering the cost side of things. And, Frank, what we have with Obamacare, both in terms of health insurance and medical care, and I'm making a clear distinction here. These are two separate conversations. No one under Obamacare is paying the right price. You're not going to pay the right price. UNCTV is not going to pay the right price. The poor person that never had health insurance is going to pay the right price. And I'm not going to pay the right price. And that is economically unsustainable.
But, you know, Michael Porter is a guy who answered that question. He says we're not, and he's the guy who's at Harvard MBA professor, you know.
He's a man with opinion.
He's a man with an opinion, yep. But he's a well-respected guy in your business, right?
Yep.
And he said the reason none of us are paying the right price is because insurance companies have really messed up the system. They're the levers, and they're acting as intermediaries when we should have a direct relationship between the user, me, the patient, and the supplier, a hospital and a doctor. What are these insurance companies doing? Getting huge leverage in markets like North Carolina and dictating the price of health care when they tell hospitals what they're going to pay, tell doctors what they're going to pay.
I agree completely, Frank. That is a result of government regulation. That's a result of state and local and federal governments complicating the free market system of insurance. If I'm an insurance guy and I come for ask for special privilege from you, the state official, the federal official, who's wrong? The guy asking or the person that gives it? Right? The inefficiency that comes from the insurance market is part and parcel of a public policy problem. It's part and parcel of the power of money in politics. You're right about insurance market. You're right that prior to Obamacare, we had real challenges that need to be corrected. But those challenges always came from the public sector because of their intervention in the private sector. Now, insurance companies, we can cite dozens of examples where they're also the bad guy. And we can't lose sight of that. And so somehow we need to get back to a free market principle. You know, in the 1960s, 1950s, 1940s, I know it's going a long time, a whole different type of situation. Free markets dominated that. It was the intervention of government forces that complicated everything. And it's been going on for about 35, 40 years.
You talked about the influence of money in politics. You are the incumbent. Renee Elmers is going to way outspend you. She's way outspending you now. And you've
really?
Criticized. Really? Yeah, I think last I saw, she had about 500,000. And I think you were somewhere a little over 2,000.
Yeah, Frank, it's not good. And that is the power of incumbency, Frank. It is our biggest challenge. Now, I raised a good deal of money in my 2010 race that I thought I was going to be able to reach out to again. But there has clearly been word spread out amongst these several hundred constant GOP donors around the state. Don't support Frank Roach. The incumbent is who we want. And so I've not been able to tap into that flow of cash. Now, we're going to have a much better report for April 15th, and we'll have raised a good deal more money. But the gap she's going to enjoy is not going to be sharply changed. Now, of course, the key thing to point out there, Frank, is 96% of her funding for this race is going to come from PACs. And 99% of my money is going to come from individuals. I will suggest to you that I will have more individual donations than she will have at the end of this run because she has so turned her back on the constituency in the 2nd District. But this is my biggest challenge. How many ads can I run against her ads? Because as you know, Frank, on the campaign trail, we touch just a small fraction of the voters. But here I am on the radio. I'm talking to you, expressing my opinion. We're saying my name. It's another way for me to gain some traction on this. And I thank you for that. But you want your citizens to understand what we're saying. So I take advantage of these opportunities. And we're going to be smart. And we're going to try and gain as much traction and you know, exponentially improve our deficit as best we can.
Should we limit outside money?
You know, Frank, that's a conversation I've been having with a lot of people. There's a discussion that's raising that we should begin to maybe focus our concerns about fundraising within a state, within a boundary, within a district. Should we allow funds to come from outside a particular voting bloc to influence that race? I think that's a legitimate discussion. However, let me quickly fall back on the quick answer to you. No, because I believe the free speech element is important. Of course, we have this difficult distinction with corporations being people that complicates the conversation. But I don't have problems with one particular person funding someone as much as they can. Now, of course, we have campaign limits, so they can't go above $2,600, but the PACs can go as much as they want. I don't have a real problem with that. But I would be happy to have this discussion about, do we need to constrain the geographic footprint of where you can raise money? Because really, this is what gives incumbents all the power that they enjoy.
But you can see where it's – I mean, the Koch brothers, for instance, are really wealthy guys.
Sure.
They're individuals. They can they bring in an awful lot of money. They're outspending everybody in this state. They're not from here.
Sure.
And their interests have to be represented by the people to take their money. Isn't that – I mean, and they're not the only ones.
Right,
but
of course. It happens on the left as well.
I'm going to give you the hard question.
Sure.
The Koch brothers are spending a lot of money. What do you think?
You know, they have that right to do that. And the thing on the national level, of course.
Forgive me for interrupting.
I'll take that word right, of course. I'll take that word right.
Yeah, take it back.
They have that choice to do if they choose.
Well, but should they have that? I mean, can we really treat everybody equally and still have a democratic process when the 5th richest guys in the world are equal to people who live 4 blocks from here?
Sure, that's a great point, Frank. And, you know, the only distinction we have to make there when it comes to national races, public policy made by a North Carolina 2nd District Representative will affect the Koch brothers and those people that live in that part of the world. That's the one thing about public policy at the federal level. You know, it happens on both sides, Frank. I believe the free speech element is appropriate. I think disclosure could solve some of that problem, make it clear that the Koch brothers are doing this. You know, they're the bullseye on the target right now. But it happens that there's, you know, the left is much wealthier than the right. And you can see that in the presidential races.
Uh-huh.
So it's a complication. No question. It's a complication. But I think I fall back on the free speech. In fact, the Supreme Court ruled again last week among the conglomeration of donations amongst different individuals, which I think was the right ruling as well. So that's an ideological difference. I think the left and the right probably won't come to terms.
Think about this. We've got a Charlotte mayor now. He's on trial or going to be on trial for taking a bag of money, right? I mean, they've fanned the money allegedly in his ear and that. We don't want that. We do not want individuals having a meeting with a public official who's a gatekeeper, handing him a pile of cash and saying, would you do this for me? Is it any different to allow people to do it? And the only difference is they have an FEC filing.
Yeah, Frank, I wish the folks listening could see your face because I share your pain. I feel that completely. I think that's our fault, Frank, as voters. We're not doing our homework. We're not doing our oversight as voters. We elect people who we like and who can raise lots of money and run lots of ads. Why don't we elect people who are qualified? That might solve some of this problem, because when I'm a qualified individual sitting in my office and a lobbyist comes into me and tries to roll me over or give me some incentive to do something I don't really understand should be done, but he convinces me, I go ahead. But if I know what I'm talking about before that person enters my office, my ability to deflect their persuasion is much higher. I think the problem we have most often in public office is the people we elect are not qualified. And there's a whole broad range of issues they have to confront. But when you don't know the issue, you can be rolled over more easily.
You are worried about the national debt. What would you do to bring it down?
Oh, well, I'd quickly go to zero on a balanced budget. I'd quickly cut spending, raise revenue, some mix of both to get us to a balanced budget in my very first term in office.
Where are you going to cut?
Across the board, everything, the whole thing. We have overpromised, overspent in every program in the United States of America. And, of course, we can also work on the revenue side within terms of simplification of the tax code. But we've overpromised everywhere, Frank.
I mean, would that mean a cut in military spending?
Well, I have no doubt there's areas we can cut in military spending. If you're in the military and you think that every dime spent in the military is spent efficiently, I think you're kidding yourself. So there's no denying we have costs that we can find to pull out of the military. However, I would put them at the bottom of the list, but they would have to incur some cuts as well. There's no denying. You can't get around it. Frank, you know, the thing about stimulus and Keynesian economics, you know, we talk about Keynesian economics, and on the right, they don't want to hear about Keynes, and I understand why. But the problem with Keynesian economics, it was never properly practiced. We put stimulus in when aggregate demand drops, but you're supposed to remove it.
Right.
We never remove it, and that's why we're at $18 trillion in debt. So we put about $1.3 trillion in stimulus in the past 5 years. Why can't we cut $600 billion in the first year? Now, I see your face. Your face is like, whoa, that's a big number. But listen, this is the courage. This is the truth. We have a national security problem right now. The day China decides not to lend any more money to the Treasury is the day the involuntary government shutdown occurs. If we handle on our own, the pain is much less. If we let a third party handle it, the pain will be much, much greater. And Frank, again, I remind you, there's no painless solutions to the problems America confronts.
But should we be equally worried about the gap between wealthy and poor?
Yes.
And isn't that a national security issue? And if we cut the budget in programs that are helping some of the people at the bottom of this now growing list of people at the bottom, isn't that a national security problem?
Yes, Frank. Yes, it is. And I talk about it in my book, Five, The Five Structural Barriers to American Strength and Prosperity. I bring together the what we talk about in the campaign trail and in our kitchen tables to the economic policy mistakes in Washington, D.C. Frank, the wealth gap is a real problem. And it is a national security issue. And it's tied directly to public policy in Washington, D.C., Frank. And it's related to immigration. It's related to deficits and debt. It's related to unilateral free trade policy with China. It's related to Obamacare and Dodd-Frank and overregulation. It's related to our failing education system, where whole swaths of our populations in urban and rural areas are being left behind.
Let me tell you, trade agreements and back to immigration. In both cases, it sounds to me like you don't like unilateral trade agreements, but those are so-called free trade agreements.
Right.
Would that lead to protectionism and higher prices? If we change our immigration policy, does that lead to higher prices? It'd be great if we treated labor fairly and raised everybody's salary. I'm all for it.
Sure.
I think everybody should be paid more, but that will raise prices. Are we ready to raise prices to protect American industries and protect American jobs?
You're right, Frank. You're obviously very astute. There is an inflationary impact to trying to rebalance our trade policy in terms of free and fair trade instead of unilateral free trade. Now, that could be as a result of China lowering their barriers to U.S. or the U.S. raising our barriers. What I'm looking for, Frank, is reciprocity from our trade partners. You want to keep low barriers? We're happy to do it. Drop yours, because we've dropped ours 25 years ago, and you've been kicking our butt ever since. So, yes, there is a potential inflationary impact, in changing trade policy. Doesn't have to be. It depends on which way we have to go. But we cannot sustain this loss of job and this transfer of wealth overseas much longer.
You know, you're good at this. You should have a radio show.
Thank you, Frank.
Frank Roach, Frank Roach, financial market economist, talk show host, and he's running against incumbent Renee Elmers to represent North Carolina's 2nd Congressional District. Thanks so much, Frank.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be with you.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things. There is more just ahead. Stay tuned.